Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Matt Cholley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Today, what have you got in your loft that's a bit political and might be worth some money? We play Political Antiques Roadshow with the auctioneer who is selling off Betty Boothroyd's knickknacks. And we hear from the former BBC political editor who was the first presenter of Antiques Roadshow. Before that, we'll hear from James Marrier and India Knight on the situation in the Middle East. And don't forget, if you like what you hear on the podcast, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio. Listen for free on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits on Times Radio, weekdays from 10. Right, let's kick off today's episode as we always do on a Friday. Let's take a look at what we learned this week. We learned that Keir Starmer's kids are the same as the rest of us.
What's good about my kids is they don't give a stuff that I'm leader of the Labour Party, and they take the piss out of me all of the time.
We learned that Rishi Sunak has gone from railing against
the 30-year political status quo I am here to end
to insisting it's jolly good and long may it continue.
The plan that is starting to deliver the long-term change that our country needs? Or do we go back to square one?
We learned from Mark Drakeford that you can get away with breaking the speed limit if you are suffering from
genuine confusion.
We learned from Andrea Leadsom that you have teeth from 18 months before you were born.
In the opposition's proposal today, they're talking about supervised toothbrushing for 3 to 5-year-olds. Now, I don't know if they don't know this, but actually you have teeth from before you're born. So if you don't get your supervised toothbrushing until you're 3, at a minimum, that's about, your teeth are about 4.5 years old.
Talking to people of 4.5 years old, we learned from 4-year-old listener Cordelia what she thinks of Keir Starmer.
I like him.
Yeah? Do you know what his job
is? It's because of his clothes.
We learned that voters on our focus group aren't thrilled by the prospect of choosing between Sunak and Starmer.
It's almost saying, you know, who's the best looking guy in the Burns unit.
We learned that Lindsay Hoyle thinks Keir Starmer's already in number 10.
A very important topic, and I take it seriously. I hope members also wish to start taking it seriously. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker.
Sorry, what was that?
Prime Minister.
All of which means the main thing we learned this week is
new year, new nonsense.
And that is what we learned this week. Now it's time for these two.
The Columnists with Knight at the Marriott, India Knight and James Marriott.
I was hunched on my bedroom floor of my laptop, frantically battering away at my column.
James is shaking his head at that. We had a vote, James. The people
I know, but
spoke.
This show isn't a democracy. You can't stop running it that way.
Right, it's not.
You're in charge and you should listen to me.
I'm in charge and it's staying. Anyway, good morning to you, Jax. Hello, India.
Hi, good morning. I'm very happy that order has been restored.
Good. I'm very pleased. Yeah, I'm in charge and that's what
I think we need an embarrassing India clip. Has India said anything embarrassing or made inadvertent sexual innuendos?
No, you can't top battering away at your
I'm going to try and...
not going to happen.
I'm going to try and force India to do sexual innuendos.
It was with you, wasn't it? We were talking about eating in the bath.
Yeah.
And somebody had a baguette, and I said, I committed a double entendre.
Let's do that. That's.
Yeah.
What flexed very poorly on you.
Somebody said they were eating a baguette in the bath, and I said you didn't want that because you might dip your end in or something.
I've tried to erase that episode from my mind.
Right, so let's concentrate because there's lots of important news around. Overnight, we got the news of these airstrikes on Houthis after they were targeting ships in the Red Sea. Somewhat inevitably, the Lib Dems and the SNP are calling for Parliament to be recalled. We've just heard in the last few minutes, Lindsay Hoyle is saying he's very happy to facilitate the recall of Parliament.
India, what do you make of this? Because it's a sort of this convention that Parliament must have its say and must vote before Britain commits any sort of military action. It's sort of emerged off the back of Iraq and so on. But should the Prime Minister ultimately be able to do this without asking the Lib Dems first?
Yes, I think he should. It's kind of the point of being Prime Minister, isn't it? Obviously, if there's a kind of going to war situation, then of course Parliament should be recalled. But in this particular instance, time is obviously a factor. It takes a while to recall Parliament. They're back on Monday anyway. I think it's fine in this instance to have just gone ahead, taken the decision and done it.
What do you think, Joyce?
Yeah, I think, the thing that's hanging in everyone's mind, obviously, is the airstrike on Syria that never happened. That, you know, Parliament was recalled when David Cameron wanted to make an airstrike on Syria, you know, with those lessons of the Iraq war kind of hanging in the back of his mind. Ed Miliband objected. And then, you know, we all think, had we intervened in Syria at that point, might have averted this kind of long and horrible civil war, which may very well have been the case. And, yeah, there is often a case for, you know, we've elected the Prime Minister to make decisions like this. You know, that's one of the things that you imagine voters are considering when they're voting. Is this someone we trust to, you know, intervene decisively? And that's one of the powers that you get as Prime Minister. It's not like in, you know, in America where, you know, we have to consult, the President has to consult Congress.
Yeah. And I suppose it's also, to some extent, these things, you want the element of surprise. actually, you know, clearly it was likely to come, but you want, if you are launching military, I'm not a military strategist myself, but if you are launching military action, the element of surprise and not laying out all of your plans to all the strategy. It's interesting, Dave's just got in touch saying, David Bowie says, surely in this day and age, Parliament can be recalled exceptionally online. You could have a Zoom recall, which is not a bad idea, I suppose. Because they did do that during the, I think they might have dismantled all of the technology that they had.
And I mean, I by no means think it's kind of obvious that Parliament should or should. It's probably a case-by-case basis, I think, isn't it? Because every intervention will be of a different magnitude and there'll be points at which something becomes so big that obviously we'd want Parliament to have a say because the repercussions, you know, for the country, for the economy, for the world, we might not want one person taking that decision alone. I think it's got to be on a case-by-case basis.
I suppose the other thing that this intervention now demonstrates India is just how much politics has changed. That you've got Keir Starmer, you know, not a cigarette paper between him and the Conservative Prime Minister, in a way that, you know, if Jeremy Corbyn was still Prime Minister, if Jeremy Corbyn was still leader of the Labour Party, I imagine he'd have a very different.
Yeah, absolutely. Imagine that. God. Yes. No, there isn't a cigarette paper between them, and I suppose, again, in these sorts of circumstances, that's probably quite a good thing, you know, to have general accord and to be able to go on to be able to, as it were, strike decisively. I don't mean literally strike decisively also, although there's that too.
And this is also one of those moments where Keir Starmer knows that he can show that he's not Jeremy Corbyn by, taking the non-Jeremy Corbyn stance. And I think that text message that was sent to Labour MPs saying, you know, don't say anything on social media, stick to the line that we saw coming out earlier. He's, you know, this is a very clear opportunity for him.
Yeah.
I guess like the stuff over the Gaza ceasefire earlier, where he can just absolutely firmly distinguish himself in the public's mind from Jeremy Corbyn.
We wait to see. I mean, I suspect there'll be lots of people all over the weekend calling for Parliament to be recalled. And before you know it, it'll be Monday and they'll be back anyway. James, let's talk about your column this week. Why don't you explain what it said, rather than me trying to...
whether I'm going to do a good job of explaining my own column this week, maybe...
It's
maybe
sort of the enlightenment discuss.
Yes, basically, in 800 words, go. I don't know, one of the kind of big themes that fascinates me at the moment is all these people who are very upset that, you know, the West lacks confidence, that in the past we really believed in ourselves and we backed our values and, you know... And there's a lot of anxiety among liberals in the West that illiberal countries, you know, like China or Russia, have a lot of confidence in their values and in what they stand for, in a way that the West is just this kind of decadent mess of doubt and no one can make their minds up and everyone's sort of infighting and arguing over culture war stuff. And then there's a real, you know, that's something that Putin's mentioned a lot. Out of the Ukraine war, who's giving these speeches calling the West kind of this decadent mess compared to, you know, these kind of firm Russian values. And I think... This anxiety has been picked up by a lot of liberals, And the point of my column actually was that if you look at our history, probably the greatest virtues of, you know, Western culture, if you want to call it that, are doubt, anxiety, self-hatred. And in my column, I was just kind of going back through some, I thought, some kind of fun historical examples of the way that, you know, our history is filled with people saying, oh, we have the Industrial Revolution. Oh, it's terrible. A lot of people think imperialism was marvelous at the beginning of the 19th century, but also we forget that lots of people thought it was terrible, and we've always been fighting ourselves, and that's not a modern thing that we should be worried about. It might actually be our biggest strength. If that, does that made sense?
I think hopefully. So.
Okay, good.
What did you think, India? And I suppose it was interesting, there was a line in James' column where he said, you know, the causation and correlation of us, are we gloomy because...
Exactly, yeah. Are we gloomy because, things are going terribly wrong, or is the fact that we're gloomy making things going terrible?
Yes.
Making things go
wrong?
Would
it help if we cheered up, India?
I'm all for cheering up. I think the West is a bit broken. I think whichever way you spin it, the current West is maybe not quite what it was. And I completely agree with James that you need friction and discord and argumentativeness and discontentment to come up with interesting new ideas. So that's fine. That's all good. There was a thing earlier this week, or maybe even yesterday, about young people voting for strongmen. What was it? Was it a poll? Was it a thing?
There's been a few surveys which show that the young people sort of like the idea of the strongman, and that
there was
a dictatorship might be better.
There was one last year, wasn't there, that said, you know, do you think we should have a strong leader who isn't bound by parliament or something? And a lot of people apparently agreed with that.
Yeah, and there was one 2-3 days ago, I think, as well, which is disturbing and also quite interesting. So yeah, I kind of agree with James's column, but I think the West is more broken than he suggests.
So what should we do about it, James?
What should we do about it? Well, I guess on the basis of my column, you know, keep arguing, keep fighting. Self-doubt isn't anything new. And often that's the thing that, you know, because we're always relitigating our values and always asking questions about our institutions and stuff, that's what allows us to develop. And if we were just full of blithe confidence, which, you know, is what a lot of autocracies want, you know, everyone has to believe in the party and the institutions of the party, then you don't really change, and that makes you quite brittle. I think we're kind of, the argumentativeness makes us supple. Although I think there is obviously a case that we are, you know, healthy argument can become polarization. Although I have to say, one thing I'm a bit optimistic about is all that stuff about young people wanting to vote for authoritarian leaders. I'm always a bit sceptical about those surveys, because I think I've seen stuff that's found, you know, actually support for democracy is quite strong. And I sometimes wonder, are those questions being asked in a way that is meant to elicit a slightly shocking answer? And I don't know, I'm always a bit cautious of whether we can actually trust those alarming sounding reports.
Yeah, so this is the one that came out, this was last September. There was an international survey in 30 countries, found 86% of people overall preferred to live in a democratic state. And only 20% thought authoritarian regimes are more capable of delivering what citizens want. But among 18 to 35-year-olds, only 57% thought democracy was preferable, rising to 71% of those over the age of 56. So,
yeah. And they have a point, because in terms of this radio show, at least, the democratic vote has not been doing well for me. And I favour an authoritarian regime, especially with regards to what clips we play beforehand.
Do you? Yeah. But that is what you've got. You have got an authoritarian regime.
No, you bent to the will of the people. You didn't.
No, but it just happened. I know, but it also happened to agree with me.
No, you were saying to me at the beginning of this year, maybe we'll get rid of the horrible, embarrassing clip. And then people voted, and you just couldn't, you know, fail to stand up to your listeners.
Fine, believe it there.
We know who really runs this show.
We'll know. The other thing I thought was interesting in your column, this idea of people doing analysis using AI, feeding, how many books was it?
Which I'm so skeptical of. This was sort of,
thousands of books from the last 400
this
years.
This was where it started, and this is the kind of fashionable new way to do history, is that these economists, they studied a German university, had fed, almost 200,000 books into an algorithm, and the algorithm was supposed to pick up words, you know, about positivity and progress and is everything going marvelously. And allegedly, this algorithm would discern trends in all these books, which would tell them what the trends in the wider culture were. And the argument of this paper was that we'd been getting more and more kind of boosterish and positive throughout the 18th century and more optimistic about technology. And it was those sentiments that had allegedly been technologically plucked out of these books that were probably responsible for us having the Industrial Revolution and becoming a world power. And after a certain point, I think, you know, when you've got one wiggly line which allegedly explains like a century's worth of human history, I just get a bit sceptical. And I guess the other part of my column was just saying, you know, old-fashioned history, actually reading books and asking which books are more influential than other books and what people are, you know, thinking other than what an algorithm says is sometimes better. And
but also
just because it's an algorithm doesn't mean it's right.
The point that you made was that if you did that fed into your algorithm, the AI bot, all of the published works in North Korea, you might think it was a lovely place to
yeah,
live.
Yeah, exactly. And so books aren't books.
It goes
everything.
Back to the whole point that what you get out is only as good as what you've put into it.
Yeah, and there was some.
You could have two books published. You know, think last year you've had a book published by, I don't know, James O'Brien saying the whole country's going to the dogs, and a book published by, I don't know, Nadine Doyce saying that it isn't. Do you know what I mean?
So, yeah, exactly.
So, and it's yeah.
And there were some great comments from the readers below the line saying, you know, well, all the kind of, you know, peasants having horrible lives who weren't writing books about how depressed they felt in the 18th century, none of that is picked up by a survey, so that doesn't mean that everyone's feeling really positive. You know, if you're living in a slum in the Industrial Revolution, you're not writing a book about it, but you probably do feel pretty depressed. So the thing is very flawed, and I don't know, I think people are kind of too love to think that algorithms can tell us everything.
Yeah.
Disapprove.
Yeah, quite right. I certainly don't want us to be replaced by AI. Right, let's move on, because I want to talk about, I'm really interested, I've got a sort of vested interest in this. Do the accents used in adverts, are they a problem? Apparently Channel 4 has found that TV adverts are using class and accents in stereotypical ways. Apparently Scottish accents are used for bank ads. It says because of the stereotype is they're tight with money. I thought it was just because they were sort of seen as reassuring and trustworthy. But if you want a character in an advert to seem stupid, they give them a West Country accent, which obviously I find deeply offensive, although I don't have a West Country accent myself. But lots of my family do. Have you noticed this?
It's English butter through and through.
Through and through!
Tasty, fresh and creamy too.
Creamy too.
Oh, you'll never put a better bit of butter on your knife. And so the toast is country life.
What are you thinking here? Should people stop treating West Country folk as, I don't know, thick yokels?
It's not just West Country folk. I think accents are used in a really kind of old-fashioned seeming way still. So, you have rural accents that are supposed to indicate a kind of deep well of folk wisdom. You have Scottish accents, which are supposed to indicate either violence or fiscal prudence. You have people from the southeast denoting kind of snootiness and kind of artsy-fartsiness. And it's all a bit reductive. And then you have northern, you know, generic northern accents denoting speaking as you find. So, yeah, it is all very reductive. And I would quite like people to play around with the accents and have, you know, a voiceover for Waitrose in a West Country accent. Yeah, why not? Or, you know.
This is not just food, this is M&S food.
I think you've got a second career.
Yeah, I could do that, couldn't I?
Yeah, it is amazing that, you know, decades after we finally decided that newsreaders don't have to speak in RP and can have regional accents in the news, these stereotypes are so ingrained. It's interesting what India says about, you know, rural versus town accents. I think I once read a study saying that when you ask people to list their favourite British accents from most favourite to least favourite, the ones that people like most tend to be rural, and the ones that people object to are Cockney, Liverpool, Birmingham, because they make you think of, like, you know, depressing city life. Whereas people hear Yorkshire, which I think is very popular, you think of rolling dales and stuff.
But then why does the West Country fall foul as that?
West Country is also pirates, which is quite cool. Pirates always kind of talk a bit
true.
West Country, don't they? So, you know, that's something. That's
who
I
always enjoyed
next John Coleshaw.
There was when I was at the West of Waterloo, and I think the Taunton Times thing, there was a story about, I think, some sort of renegade self-styled paramilitary group that didn't like second homes in Cornwall, and there's like tried to set fire to them or, you know, break into them or whatever, and they were dubbed the URA. which is dubbed, obviously, by like a tabloid headline writer rather than anyone else, but I always particularly enjoyed that. Somebody's just got in touch, actually, pointing out precisely the point that Matt in Nottingham says, Matt, you not having a West Country accent shows that it is important. Presumably you chose not to have one. You wouldn't be the influential media kingpin that you are if you spoke like the Wurzels. It's interesting.
What's happened to your accent? Has your accent naturally eroded with being in London?
As far as I know, I don't think I've ever been, because my brother is a bit more, and I've got like uncles and cousins and things who are quite, and if I go back to Somerset, I will slightly drift into it.
Do they think that you sound like you're from London now? Do they?
No, because I think I've always sounded like that. I think there's a lot of it to do with your sort of friends at school.
Yeah, that's a good point. I used to have a little bit of a Geordie accent at school.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And I literally made a conscious effort to get rid of it, which is, I'm very ashamed of in hindsight.
India Knight and James Barrett there. Of course, you can read them in The Times and The Sunday Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next is the Political Antiques Roadshow.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Thing.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome to Antiques Roadshow without the boring bits. Yeah, we're not looking at any of your Chippendale chairs or carriage clocks that you found in your granny's attic today. No, we're only interested in your political memorabilia. The former Commons Speaker Betty Boothroyd's possessions are being auctioned for charity, alongside items of jewellery, including a diamond ring that could be worth £100,000. There were some great bits of political memorabilia too, including a souvenir programme from the inauguration of John F. Kennedy, signed by John F. Kennedy, and framed photos of her meetings with the likes of Bill Clinton and Nelson Mandela. In a moment, we'll hear from the man who's holding the auction. He's brought some of it in. He's brought in some of the stuff. I'm excited about this. And then we're going to be joined by some of you, listeners, and you might even throw an MP as well. Labour MP Jess Phillips is going to pop up with some of your political memorabilia, and we're going to get it valued live on air. Will Jess Phillips be pleasantly surprised to learn that what she's got is worth a fortune, or crossed to discover it's not really worth anything? But before that, what better place to start than with the very first presenter of Antiques Roadshow back in 1979? Bruce Barker went on to be a political editor for the BBC for years in the South. But first of all, let's go right back to the birth of the Antiques Roadshow and how he got the job.
Well, firstly, not knowing anything about antiques, basically, I did a show on BBC One called Badger Watch, which was the pre-runner, if you like, of all the watches that have gone on, Spring Watch and Autumn Watch and all that. And we were looking at badgers at 10 o'clock at night through infrared cameras. And the big thing was that they'd never used infrared cameras before and all of that. A producer in Bristol saw me doing that, and a couple of days afterwards, I mean, it was all live and so on. A couple of days after that, he phoned me up from Bristol, and I was living in Winchester. Could I come down and see you, Bruce? And I said, yeah, what about? Oh, I'll tell you when I get there. So when he got there, he said, look, I've been touring West Country cities like Bristol and Exeter and Plymouth, and the auction houses like Sotheby's, Christie's, Phillips, Bonhams are holding these things called roadshows, where they have people who come in, have their stuff valued free. And he said, I've been watching their reactions. You know, when it's worth a lot, they're delighted. But when it's worth sweet FA, they're all a bit cross and tearful and so on, you know. And I said, yeah, so. And he said, well, you know, would it, do you think it would make a good program? And I said, well, yeah, I think it probably would. So what have I got to do with that? He said, well, I'd like you to help me do it, put it together, devise it, and then be the presenter. And I'd like you to be the presenter and Arthur Negus, whom your listeners will remember, as the expert. So he was 70, I was 35, you know, he was double my age. And you know, that was the duo. And then we did the pilot in Hereford.
And so how long were you then the presenter of Antiques Roadshow for?
Well, I only did a couple of years because I'm a journalist and I was a freelance, like most people in the BBC were then. I had a day job. I was doing the BBC South Today every night in, I think, your neck of the woods, probably, in Hampshire. Yeah. And I didn't know whether the roadshow was going to carry on or whatever. And I had to make a decision, say, you know, do I actually do these other things or do I stick with news and current affairs and so on? So I stuck with news and current affairs. I mean, I don't regret it because I ended up as BBC South's political editor. And my other love was politics. And I ended up as a member of the press gallery and so on. And I can't think of anything I would have wanted to do other than that.
We'll come to Member Billy in a moment, but you picked up a lot of certainly political experience and anecdotes along the way, interviewing every prime minister from Eden to Cameron. That's a pretty, well, yeah, you know, both slightly responsible for catastrophic foreign policy decisions.
They weren't in office at the time, some of them. I mean, you know, so not that old. But yeah, some of them were strange. I mean, I first interviewed Ted Heath, actually, when he's leader of the opposition, and that was in Southampton. And I went down to meet him outside the building, which is the old Southwestern House there, which was the Cunard building where the BBC was, and met him, got in the lift. I got stuck in the lift with him.
And how was that? Because he wasn't necessarily a man known for his interpersonal skills.
Well, I was just about to say, he's not exactly this. You know, there are people that you might want to be stuck in a lift with, but he's not one of them, is he? Or wasn't. He just didn't want to say anything. It was only about 3 minutes when we got sort of hauled up and got out of the lift, you know. But, I mean, you know, what a way to start, eh? With him.
That's pretty extraordinary. It's pretty extraordinary. And your memories of that period of covering politics such a long time, and I know from when I was the sort of political editor for the Western Body News, when you've got your own patch, particularly when it suddenly becomes quite an interesting patch politically, you do actually get more access to some of these leaders of the opposition and prime ministers than you do if you're a sort of middle-ranking lobby journalist on a national newspaper. So you must, you know, you saw them all up close and personal.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, they all wanted to be on television. Although prime ministers, actually, before, I don't know when, 1990s, didn't actually think they had to go on television. They, you know, they did Panorama, perhaps, and then they did the party conferences. And the party conferences, of course, in those days were huge things. I know covered by BBC One Live and everything else, because that was the one time the public actually got to see not only the Prime Minister, but the members of the Cabinet or Shadow Cabinet or whatever, because Parliament itself wasn't being televised either. So the impact of doing interviews with people like me and others was actually greater than it is now, because people are actually seeing the politicians of the, well, rarely, you know, or the first time even.
Did you then keep an interest in antiques memorabilia? Did you collect any political memorabilia along the way?
I mean, I was an anorak when I was a boy, and I used to stand outside. Downing Street. In those days, you could. I mean, there was no barrier or anything. In fact, later on, when I did that as a boy, when I you know, could drive a car, I remember driving the car up there, showing my family and driving out again. But I used to write to people like Churchill, you know, and wish him a happy birthday and so on. And I'd get a letter back, but it was, I think it was a copy, you know, a photocopy and so on. But I wrote asking Anthony Eden I've got it here in front of me, in 1955 for his autograph, you know, because we used to collect autographs in those days too. So what was I, about 13 or so? 1955. Dear Master Parker, the Prime Minister has asked me to send you the enclosed autograph with his best wishes. Yours sincerely, somebody, Otto, private secretary, Master B.R.W. Parker, and there's his autograph, you know.
So. And it's so interesting, isn't it? Because these days people might get a selfie if they bump into someone, but then what do you do with that? It's just on your phone. It's not, you know, the physical connection to the person that you're trying to connect with doesn't exist in quite the same way. Autographs are so interesting.
I prize that. But I also prize, I've got hanging up in my study here, a letter from Tony Blair when I retired from the BBC, a long letter, you know, personal letter, saying thanks very much for what you've done and all of that. I mean, that was, it was presented to me at my leaving dinner, and I thought, oh my God, yeah, that's quite something. So that's sort of memorabilia.
You haven't taken your, you haven't combined your two interests to the extent of buying memorabilia. You know, this Betty Boothroyd auction, which got us thinking about all this. You're not going to fork out and start bidding for some of these items?
Well, no. I mean, I've been looking at the catalogue. I mean, it was fascinating because, you know, I know there's a dispatch box and so on, but I mean, there's a Buckingham Palace shower cap amongst the items here. I mean, it raises so many questions. how did she get a Buckingham Palace shower cap? Did she stay there? You know, did she use the bathroom? I mean, presumably she wanted to go to the loo at some point. I don't know if she was there for some meeting or other. But a shower cap, you know, did it have a royal cipher on it? Or
it must do. It must be listed like that.
Well, the estimated price is £30 to £50. But I mean, the next question is, who's going to buy something like that?
Yeah, because I suppose it's not the same as being able to say, look, this is an autograph or something. This is a Buckingham Palace shower clap once owned by Betty Boothroyd for £30.
Yeah, but the big questions are, what does she do with it? I mean, did she wear it?
Maybe it's worth more if she actually wore it.
Well, there's something else in the list here. You know, a collection of frog-related items, including two flat kermits, paper toad with mortarboard, and various enamel frog boxes.
Bruce, you don't sound very persuaded. You know, if I were you, I'd stick with your Eden autograph.
Well, I wouldn't mind the letter from Blair.
I think that might go for red box. Yeah. I know a red box would be quite good, but I think that might go for quite a lot more. Well, listen, Bruce, it's been lovely to speak to you. There's nothing better when the guest booking jackpot hits, where we find the first presenter of the Antics Roadshow, who then became a long-standing political editor and member of the political press gallery. Bruce Parker, thanks so much for joining us on Times Radio.
Very kind of you. Enjoyed it very much.
And I'm joined now in the studio by Thomas Forrester from Special Auction Services. He's auctioning off items belonging to the former Commons Speaker, Baroness Betty Boothroyd. And you've brought some things in. Thomas, good to see you.
Good to see you, Matt. Yeah.
So I can see you've got lots of things in front of you. What have you got?
So to start off, I've got the Betty Boothroyd dispatch box. It is black leather, opens quite extraordinarily from... the base, actually, because the handle's up here.
Yeah, like, so it's like a ministerial, sort of like the budget box.
But yeah, like the budget box.
But it's black rather than red that most people are used to.
The speaker's box.
Yeah.
And inside the speaker's box is a Dunhill little wallet. And inside the wallet are her business cards.
Very nice. Yeah,
the Right Honourable Baroness Boothroyd OM.
And so does that all come together?
That comes as a lot.
Comes as a lot.
Now, the one issue I have, and with this, even with her own elastic bands in there and a sort of old elastic band at the back, I haven't touched anything, cleaned it up. Everybody's asking, where's the key?
Is there not a key?
I cleared the house. I went through her desk. I couldn't find the key.
So you can't really carry it by the handle because all the bits will fall out.
Exactly. However... Yeah. You can get keys cut.
Okay.
You could go to Brahma here in London or Chubb and they will sort you out.
They'll do one. Mm. And how much do you expect that to go for when it does go
I think it's going to go for quite a lot of money. I've been quite conservative. I've said, you know, in the mid-hundreds, but I reckon it's going to be maybe £2,000.
Wow.
I think so. I think it's going to go four figures easily.
And what else have you got there? If that's a bit much for people.
Well, if it's a bit much for people, I have got her... portcullis brooch. Her diamond set, 18 karat gold portcullis brooch.
Can I have a look at that? Of course I promise I won't put it in my pocket.
No, it's fine. So this is worn, she had three of them. She had an early Edwardian one, which is 15 karat gold, and 15 karat gold stopped being essayed in about 1932. But this is a modern 18 karat gold one with diamonds to the crown and to the portcullis itself.
I mean, there's a lot of bling on there. And you can see this in lots of photos that she had taken.
Yeah, this was worn all the time. You know, here
so, Is that the UN she's wearing?
That's the UN.
And how much are we talking for this one? Presumably it's got just an intrinsic value because it's gold and diamonds with an added sort of Betty Booth voice bit on top.
Absolutely. If you ask any of our jewellery dealers, what's it weigh? That's all they're interested in.
Yeah.
No, it's worth about £1,200 to £1,800.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, I want to give that back to you before I drop
it. Okay, it's all right.
I don't want to off. Anything else you've got?
We've got loads of stuff. So I'm really intrigued. I love old photographs.
Yeah.
And we've all got old photographs. And we have got a plethora of photographs relating to her ladyship. But I think some of the most interesting ones are the early ones. Mm. So here's a selection of... This is her in America, on the Kennedy campaign.
Yeah.
And that's her in Capitol Hill there, looking fabulous. Here she is at her desk, looking...
Head in hands.
Looking absolutely, spaced out. And another one there. While I was going through them, I found them here, her with Ho Chi Minh.
Wow.
Yeah, have a look at that.
I mean, it's a reminder, actually, because people sort of really just remember as being in the chair in the House of Commons, but what a life and a political career that she...
Kennedy?
Well, yeah, so I want to ask about the Kennedys, because it's not just that she worked on the campaign. Is it the prize lot in terms of what it's going to go for? The programme from the inauguration. You've brought it in?
I have, yes, I have.
Can I have a look at it?
Of course you can.
My goodness.
So it's a limited edition.
Yeah.
It is much loved because it's so worn.
So this is the... So it says on the front, the official inaugural programme, January the 20th, 1961. It's the programme from JFK's inauguration.
Yeah. And you've just... Yeah, the signature's just there on your... You've just turned over. That one there. There. To the dedication.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's a souvenir programme because the Moroccan leather, or the leather as we call it, has been embossed Betty Boothroyd.
Yes, so it's got her sort of...
Yeah, and it's a limited edition one.
So it's two Betty Boothroyd with very best wishes.
Yeah, very best wishes.
John Kennedy.
Yeah.
That's properly good, isn't it?
That is properly
good. But you're so right, it's almost falling to pieces. I haven't broken it. Falling to pieces. Which does suggest that she was, keen to get it out of the drawer and show people and all of that.
I'm convinced. I mean, I went through her bookcase when I was clearing the property. We went there like 3 or 4 times clearing, and I was going through the bookcase because quite a few books there dedicated. There's one from Barbara Castle about her meteoric rise, and there's John Major, and it's just really interesting. And then in sort of the larger volumes, this was slipped in. And I pulled it, I went, really? It was like one of those moments. An Indiana Jones moment. Really?
So how much is this going to go for, do you think?
There's quite a bit of interest. I think it's going to go for maybe $1,200 to $1,500. I only estimated it $300 to $500.
Well,
we don't know.
JFK and
There's a lot of watchers online watching. It's a live auction, but we can see the pre-auction interest.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be quite popular.
I shall give it back to you so I don't break it. Now, because we knew you were coming in, and we know that the sort of people who listen to the show are the sort of people who might have other political memorabilia. So many people have sent things in, so we're going to try and get through as many as we can. Joining us in the studio is Seth. And Seth, what have you brought in?
I have Gladstone's dispatch box from the 1850s when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Now, when you tweeted this to me this week, I thought, that can't be right. But you really have.
Yes,
and you brought it in.
Yeah.
So it's a big... It looks very different.
It's an early dispatch box.
Looks different to the Betty Boothroyd one. It's the same as we're familiar with, the sort of ministerial box. This looks more like a sort of brown leather satchel.
And these literally are built for dispatches on horseback. I mean, that's the way that they're built. So it's very different from that. I can open it up. You'll see it's made of calf skin. It's a very unusual sort of thing. But yes, very rustic.
What's that?
The note is from the last time it was auctioned. Well, I bought it from the estate of Lord Avebury, the Lib Dem peer.
Yeah.
He bought it when he was a Liberal MP in the 1960s from the grandson of a Gladstone family friend. Has been fully authenticated at that date, and that was describing the contents of it as it was then.
So it says the leather dispatch box is understood to have been Mr. Gladstone's when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer. There was a label on the box with his name on, written, I understand, in his own handwriting.
And there is the label.
Yes, it says Fask, which is the name of his father's castle in Scotland.
So Gladstone wrote that himself?
Yes, that's his handwriting. If you see his signature, it matches up perfectly.
So how old is this?
170-ish years old.
Well, it's not in bad, Nick. It was quite good. So, I suppose the big question is, Thomas.
Yes.
Well, can you, will you tell us how much you paid for it?
Yes. Do you want to guess first, or do we play this game? I can tell you what the valuation was that I was given and what I paid for it. I don't know if you've got a...
Well, I think Gladstone is an important political character.
Yeah.
Certainly, through many... many sales. I've sold bits of Gladstone. I've sold carte de visites, sold signatures. I've even sold a chipping of wood, which was chopped by Gladstone's axe and made into an inkwell.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of interest. Yeah. But actually having a political item, not a bit of ephemera.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, was used by him, as you say,
in
on the side of a hall.
In his role, rather than just something that passed through his life.
So that adds even more value to it. So I think at auction, in the right auction, not in a general sale on Bodmin Moor, no offence to Bodmin, but, you know, on a wet Tuesday afternoon, the internet makes all the difference, but I reckon that's going to be at least 3,000 to 5,000 now.
Well, I thought the valuation was lowball, and the valuation was £200 to £400, and I paid £300 for it.
Wow, £300!
Yes.
How long ago?
2 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
You've done very well there.
You've done very well.
I mean, just the signature would be worth.
I'll give you an idea of how lowball I think it is. In the same sale, I was very tempted by a 4-foot-tall statue of Gladstone.
Yeah.
And the only reason I didn't buy it is I couldn't find anywhere to keep it. I live in a first-floor flat with creaky wooden floorboards.
Yeah, but that's quite weird to have.
That's amazing.
But I mention that because the valuation on that was about £1,000. It went to auction and it sold for £15,000.
Well, I think actually, then I'm justified in saying that as well.
Yes, you are fully justified.
Whoever was doing that auction, what they were doing. And you were very lucky that nobody else knew either.
It was a private sale.
So presumably you now wouldn't part with it.
No, but I'm very happy to, put it on sort of general display in terms of, you know, long-term loans and so on. Yeah. I'd love people to see it enjoy it.
Right, very good. Well, thank you very much for coming in with that, Seth. Now we can speak to Jess Phillips, who is obviously Labour MP, is on the line because, Jess, you've... Morning.
Morning.
How are you?
I'm all right, thanks.
So what have you got?
When I saw your tweet, I put up... So I have a compact that is in not particularly good nick. It looks slightly battered, like a powder compact that, classically women would have that you put reused powder in. That was sent to me by a Canadian man from Canada. He sent it all the way from Canada. And he'd found it in, I think, a car boot or a sale in Wales when he'd been on holiday. But when you open it up, it is... it says E. Braddock, MP, West Derby Labour Party, the 6th of the 2nd, 1948. And it is the compact that belonged to Bessie Braddock, who was one of, she was a Labour MP, and she was one of like the first sort of like 10 women ever elected to Parliament. And in certainly from the point of view of the Labour Party is seen as being like this sort of massive icon. There's a massive statue of her in Liverpool. She was a proper like sort of icon of women in politics. In fact, Johnny Reynolds, the shadow business secretary in the Labour Party, his daughter is called Bessie, named after Bessie Braddock.
Wow. So, Thomas... It's not in the best of condition.
It's terrible.
But could you just show it to the camera again?
Hold it up again on the Zoom, Jeff.
Are we going to get it again? It looked like it was sort of brass, base metal.
Yeah.
It does look brass, yeah.
It does look brass.
She was brassy, so.
And well, being, you know, a staunch Labour MP, and she was a member of the Communist Party to begin with, wasn't she, in the 20s?
She was, yeah.
So she wouldn't have had... she wouldn't have had anything too glitzy and sort of, you know, non-ferrous metal, you know, gold and silver. That would be a bit too much. But in brass, the actual compact itself is relatively collectible, but not that valuable. People like to collect compacts.
They do. We'll see them all the time.
But that provenance makes all the difference.
So if Jess were to part with it?
If she were to part with it, which I'd advise...
What would you value it at?
I don't think I'd go stronger than £200 to £300.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
That's not bad for something that somebody found in a car boot sale. And what about if you had an engraved Jess Phillips compact? How much would that go for?
Oh, well, that is just going to be priceless.
Chris Phillips never powders her nose, so
well,
I mean, you need to start.
You need
I know. I mean, it'll just be like Rimmel. Or whatever.
Just write your name. Just write your name on the back of a wheel. Well, just thank you for coming on and sharing it with us. Presumably, you wouldn't part with it, but
Well, funnily enough, I always think that I will save it and give it to Johnny Reynolds' daughter.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. Yeah.
Can I just have a look at the condition? Sorry, again.
Yeah. So this is the outside. The inside is in good condition.
Yeah.
But the inside, and then you pull back this bit to get to the powder.
Yeah, and it's got a lovely mirror. The mirror was
mirror is good.
It's got that lovely beveled edge to it.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, it is. The mirror is really nice.
And it's so worn on the outside. It was obviously something she carried all the time. It's like a real
And then
real
you open it up, and that's where the powder pack. And you
very,
put in.
You're very lucky that's no longer in there. We often open them, and they're still full of powder.
And
you smell like an old lady for the next day.
Jess, I like that.
Jess, thank you for sending that for joining us to show us. Well, that's Jess Phillips of the Labour MP. I think we've got another. We've got Paul. Is Paul on the line? Paul, are you there?
Called him out.
Paul, what have you got?
Oh, I've got a bag of Politi crisps.
A bag of crisps. Right, let's have a look.
Well, they've got Nick Clegg's face on the front of them. Can you see those there?
Go the other way. That's it.
There we are. So Paul is a Times 20 listener who's got in touch. He's got, they're called Real Election Hand-Cut Sea Salt Politi crisps. This is from 20. I remember being sent some of these. Was this 2010 or 2015?
2010, Matt, and the best before date is 17th of July 2010.
Thomas, can you put a value on such an item?
I think that says it all, really, doesn't it? I mean, best before.
Nick Clegg. Best before. But yeah, 2010.
I think the only good thing which has come out of that sort of political alliance is I once read a cooking article from his wife, who's Spanish, isn't she?
Yeah.
And she told me how to do a proper tortilla.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so really, with these chips here.
Yes, exactly.
With these, you know, with these crisps here, I think we're looking at, you know, no more than £10 to £20.
£10 to £20.
I reckon I could get £10 to £20 at an auction for them.
Yeah. Would I pay? No, I wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't.
Would you ever part with them, Paul?
I'd never part with them. Family.
Seth, thank you so much for bringing that in. I suggest you leave, otherwise I'm going to try and nick it, because that is brilliant, your class. I'll be honest, Paul, you can keep your crisps.
Thanks, Matt.
Paul, thanks for coming on there. But did you buy them, or were you sent them, those crisps?
No, I work for a PR company in London.
And
you get the odd big box of things that a company wants you to probably talk up on their behalf. So, no, I didn't buy them.
You didn't buy them. I remember us being sent them in the press gallery, those crisps. They've been doing for all the different party leaders. And if you want to boast about things that you've got in your loft of a political nature, then you can email me, matt@times.radio. It'd be nice to hear from you. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.